Welcome to the DanceX OXO show, helping dancers embrace their dreams in the real world. This episode is sponsored by GalleriaMaria.com, quenching your thirst for lifelong learning with online courses, podcasts, ebooks, and more. And now, here's your host, Annika Valentine.
Hello, and welcome to today's show. I'm Annika Valentine. I'm a dancer and violinist living my dream. Follow me on my blog at AnnikaValentine.com, where I bring you behind the curtain. Today I'm excited to share my interview with Janice Barringer, co-author of the world-renowned Point Shoe book, the most comprehensive book on point shoes I've ever seen. Every serious ballet dancer should have this book. Published first in 1998, the book, now in its third printing, has withstood the test of time and has become a go-to resource for the ballet industry. Barringer's rich background as a professional dancer and teacher add value to this resource. So I hope you enjoy my chat with Janice Barringer, her experience writing the book as well as stories from her long and varied career are fascinating. Make sure to sign up for my email updates where you can get free access to my street corner recordings and updates on my podcasts and more.
And now, without further ado, here's Annika Valentine and Janice Barringer.
So I studied a bit in England and took a few classes in Germany and then decided to come back. And I really got latched onto my teacher, finally, David Howard, that I studied with my whole life until he died last year. And I danced with a few companies, New York Dance Theater. I started there. And then I danced with the Baltimore Ballet for a long time and worked with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Used to do a lot of educational shows, and particularly about dance, and would take them everywhere. So I was sort of the soloist for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And then way back with when public television was kind of new, because I'm really old, I did a couple of specials. It was, they called Dance in America. On public television, on PBS. And it was ballet, but also some ethnic dancing. I had some wonderful ethnic choreographers and working with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. Started working with the chamber company. It was just six dancers. I bumped into a brand new dancer who had just come from Chicago and Pittsburgh. His name was Eddie Stewart. And Eddie was the most incredible partner. He could make any dancer look good. And he and I just hit it off. So we danced together. We constantly were partnering. Then we decided that we wanted to freelance. There were a lot of politics in ballet companies. And he was really ready to quit. He just did not like the politics and some of the difficult people working with. And he was a wonderful choreographer, too. So he and I started freelancing, going in as guest artists for over 20 years. You know, when people would do Nutcracker, people would do Cinderella. In fact, when the Orlando Ballet was first new, they brought us in to star in their Cinderella.
Oh, how wonderful.
And it was a lot more fun that way because, you know, I was married, and by this time I had a little girl. And even though I had full-time help, It was much easier if Eddie and I could suddenly just cancel rehearsal because my my maid got sick. You can't do that in a company.
Yeah.
You have to be there. It's very, very stressful having a... These days, ballet companies have made it easier for people to have babies, but back when I was dancing, they did not have any sympathy whatsoever. You just did not miss rehearsals. You just didn't. You can't say, I'm staying home with my child. I used to, you know, when my maid wasn't there, I'd have to throw her off on my husband's secretary, which was not the best idea, or a friend. You couldn't do it. They're really much more understanding now. A lot of people are having babies in companies, but that did not happen back when I was young. And if you look back at The Red Shoes, the movie from, I think that was the 40s, they didn't even like the dancers to get married because they didn't feel like that, you know, you were committed enough to your art. So my best years were really my last years because Eddie choreographed. He knew me inside out. He knew exactly what my strengths were and my weaknesses. We had a real strength in lyrical movement and sort of romantic movement. And he would choreograph these most gorgeous. We choreographed a concert version of Romeo and Juliet that was just the two of us that we did that for like 25 minutes. It was exhausting. But, you know, four different sections. And it was exhausting, but it was absolutely beautiful. And like I said, we would guess with others. And near the end of that, he started a ballet company in Annapolis, Maryland. So I would come in and do most of the leads when that was starting. Then he decided that he wanted to spend all his time directing the company and choreographing. I thought, oh, no, what am I going to do without Eddie? So he assigned me to some of his partners. But anyway, I began to phase out and get into teaching. And at the end of my dancing career, I started writing as well as teaching. And I put dancing first. That was the most important thing to me. But there were less opportunities as time went by, and more people wanted me to teach. Well, I really wasn't a good teacher to start because I only knew how to teach, you know, what I knew myself. You know, like I knew whatever my weaknesses were, I knew how to teach because I had to figure them out to make them work for myself. But whatever my talents were, I didn't know how to teach because some things come easily to you. And whatever comes easily to you, if it doesn't come easily to somebody else, you don't know how to tell them what to do because you could just do it. So I started then going off constantly in the summer times particularly, and I studied a lot of Vaganova courses. I started, you know, I was really studying that method and reading books and studying anatomy books. And then one of the greatest learning opportunities is when I decided to write a book on point shoes and point training. I started going into not only interviewing famous dancers, that's what I did first, famous dancers. What kind of shoe do you wear? You know, what size? What custom adjustments do you have? How do you fix your ribbons? How do you fix your elastic? What were your strengths? What were your weaknesses? How did you fix? Am I talking too fast?
Oh, no, you're fine.
You know, I'd ask the dancers how they solved their own problems, and it was very, very helpful because everybody is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've known teachers in the past that would ask their students to wear the same shoe that they loved because it worked so well for them. But one of the reasons I was so interested in point shoes and point training is I had a very difficult foot to fit. It's not only small, and some people have small feet, but it's extremely narrow and very shallow. And most shoes are made for wide feet and plump feet.
Yeah.
So my feet used to just swim in the shoes, even when I could get the right length. I could get the right length. But, you know, I could stick my whole hand down into the box. I mean, there'd be that much room. So you know you're not stable on point when you have all that space, even when it's the right length. So most people did not make them very narrow. And I, quite young, had to start ordering a custom-made AA. And because usually the shoes that come in like narrow or medium or wide, their narrow is a B. And I wore a AA. Way back when I was pretty young and I was searching for all of this, there was a shoe that's been discontinued called Selva. It wasn't like Capizio and Selva were about the only two shoes you could get when I was young. And Capizio was just a little wide for me. That's what most of the like Orlando, that's all they carried. And you just had to sort of get what was there and try to make things work for yourself. But I was in New York once, and I found a very narrow shallow Selva, and I absolutely loved it. So then I took that. I liked the Capizio. The shoe was lighter than I liked. And I said, measure the shoe, and I want you to make a shoe for me exactly to these dimensions. And that's when I found out I wore a 2 3/4 A. I was wearing a double A in some shoes, but in their lightest shank shoe. So for years I had custom made 2 3/4 A with and they've also discontinued this. The Assolute was their lightest shoe, but their Nicolini was the narrowest shoe that they made. So I said, I want it on the last, which is the shape of the shoe, for the Nicolini, made to the the qualifications of the Assalusa because there's less glue in it, so it's a lighter shoe, and they put in the lightest shank. The Nicolini had a number two shank, which was the second lightest. The Assoluta had a number one shank. So I found that if they made it on the last of the Nicolini that was a very shallow, narrower last, to, in an A, in a three-quarter length, which was custom, and the very lightweight shank and less glue, the shoe was perfect.
Wow.
So it, that's how I got interested because and
I saw
at
other
the time,
saying,
okay, Russia was
when
the,
I moved
was
away,
communist,
you know,
I,
and
so
I discovered
were not imported
I
from Russia.
Them. Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted
mm-hmm.
a rubber shoe, they were smuggled out of the country.
You know, as
people
I got older,
sell,
more things
used
were
to
being
sell
imported.
Them to us for $2 a pair.
And at the time,
wow.
Russia,
oh my
Russia was communist.
Yes,
and so
I had a friend
were not imported
that had a friend. It wasn't
so
my friend.
Russia,
in New York,
they were smuggled
with,
out of the country, and people would sell
meat
sell them to
at night
$2
in Central Park in the summer.
Wow.
Rush.
Oh
and they would have a big bag full
yes.
of smuggled
I had a
shoes, and they would sell them.
That
to
had
for
a friend. It wasn't my friend in New York.
Oh my goodness!
Would meet at night in Central Park in the dark, and they would have a big bag full of smuggled Russian shoes, and they would sell them to them for $2 a pair.
Oh my goodness!
But none of these shoes really fit me. So like a lot of dancers, you start cobbling them. You know, you start cutting them down. You start taking tucks with big needle and thread, taking tucks in them, you know, and trying to, you know, make them work. A lot of people did that. Cause
yes.
Now the problem is there are so many types of shoes that they've made in so many different ways that nobody can remember what they are. It's hard
yes.
to find just the right shoe. In the past, we didn't have a big choice. Now the choice is so big. And honestly, the companies are not too honest about, mm-hmm. you know, they want to be secretive about how they make the shoes. They don't want other companies stealing their secret ingredients.
Oh, yeah.
And in the old days, they were all made by hand, all made by hand.
Yeah.
Then, you know, to save money, a lot of things now are made totally by machine. In the old days, they were all made like paper mache. You would use, you know, a paste, and then they would put like burlap. In England, they call it, what they call it? I can't think of it right. I'll tell you in a minute. It's burlap. And layer after layer after layer, and then let it dry. And layer after, and they'd want that so that every time you'd relevé or use it, it would break down a little bit, so it would be, it wouldn't be hard on your joints of your feet.
Oh.
That's why the shoes would wear out. Now you'd have to get new ones when they'd wear out, but if you have a shoe, a box that doesn't wear down, it's kind of like dancing on concrete, that your
mm-hmm.
joints will break down instead
exactly.
of the shoe. So anyway, there's a huge controversy now because you know, a lot of shoes don't break down at all, and then you
yes.
can wear them forever and ever. And a lot of teachers are very against that because they feel it's going to hurt your feet. But yet the manufacturers swear that it's not going to hurt your feet. So there's a big controversy about that.
Yes.
Plus, some of these companies now, you know, they actually have, like, plastic boxes.
Yep. Isn't that the Gainers?
No. Gainer Minden has what they call elastomeric. Space age, elastomeric. They call it space age, and there are other shoes. Dana Minden started it, I'm trying to think, about 15 years ago, and they do not say it's plastic. They say it's made out of materials kind of like running shoes. So
oh.
they're saying that it won't hurt you. It's not unyielding plastic. It's something
mm-hmm.
that actually yields, but it's a space age material. That's what
now,
they say.
What shoe is made of plastic, though?
What? I'm sorry?
What shoe is made of plastic thing?
Well, honestly, I kind of hate to say that because I'm afraid if I say something like that, as I'm saying, a lot of them won't say it. They won't admit it. But what you can kind of gauge from is unless they say space age elastomeric, and some others are doing it, if they say that these have long lasting or every shoe is made the same, you know, these are you can kind of guess. You can kind of guess every shoe because the ones made with paste, they're all handmade and they're not made the same. It's like making potato salad. Everybody has a recipe. Don't you think? You've never had a potato salad that's the same?
No, no, you're right.
But people have the same ingredients in, but they're just a little different. So that's one of the problems about, like, Free Shoes, for instance. You know, because somebody's making it by hand, they have a little bit of different touch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit more
of
this, a little bit more of that, a little bit different touch. So sometimes they don't always fit exactly the same. But frankly, I know Gant Mendon, I know the woman there very well. She'd kill me for saying it. But as I've gone around the world, more professional dancers that I know are wearing Freeds than any shoe that I know.
Really?
But, yes. And it's been that way since the late 80s when I started interviewing people. But more and more people are wearing gainers.
Oh, yeah.
There used to just be a few. And, of course, I know it's they're comfortable. But
yeah.
One of these things you can kind of tell, like even Freed's is making some now, like the studios kind. They're making some now. Read what the descriptions are. And if they say they're more consistent, that means they're not all handmade.
Oh, well, that's a good little trick to know.
Yeah.
Because yeah, I just got new point shoes. I got a pair of gainers and a pair of Capizios.
Uh-huh.
So it was because I've never worn gainers, and I was just trying them out. And they're comfortable, of course, but I'm having a little trouble with just the heel part. It's slipping off, but that's something I think you could fix. By rosin or the last.
Well, rosin, they actually have little pads, too, for your heels. They have pads for everything. Did you see those?
Oh, no, I did not.
They have this little thing, I've forgotten what they're called, little bag. They just have pads you can stuff here, pads you can stuff there. Well, I went down ages ago when I was still dancing, and I said, you know, my foot is impossible. We can fit you. We can fit you. So I went down. And they measured me, they did everything, and then when they brought the shoe in, honestly, it still didn't fit. I knew it wasn't going to. Because they just don't have a narrow enough last. Do you know what I'm talking about when I say a last?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, they don't have a narrow and shallow enough. So they were saying, okay, stick this pad by your toes, stick this pad at the bottom of the foot. But, you know, I don't want to wear a million pads in my shoes.
No, and
so,
really, you shouldn't wear all those. I mean, you should wear a pad, but to wear all those pads, that means the shoe is not fit correctly.
Right.
And you should try a different shoe.
But I have to say, it's really interesting. They have made it comfortable. It doesn't hurt as much as in the boxes, a lot of shoes. And people do. You have to read the instructions. I never believe when they say, this gives you perfect balance. I mean, really, that's up to you.
Exactly.
You know, that's up to you. And they say all kinds, you know, but there are some very, very strange shoes out there now. And a lot of them I really don't like because for my students now, when I try to break them in for them, I said, you could have a semi-truck run over them and they're not going to loosen up. They're just too hard. And they're made so that they won't break down so that people don't have to buy them. But you have absolutely no control of that shoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really want it to break down a bit, and you can kind of feel them with your hands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is, like, say for Capizio or Block, they have many, many different models.
Oh, yes, yes.
And their models are all made differently. Block is just unbelievable. Well, I know how this happened, though. When in 1988, 89, I went to Freed's factory, and when I was first doing the book, and I met the man who was, his name was Bernard Kohler, K-O-H-L-E-R. He knew more about point shoes than anybody in the world. He's already kind of old, and he was in charge of making all the shoes of Fries and supervise most of the company's custom models. He knew so much about it. Then showed me all through the factory, explained everything. Then, in a short while, I saw that he was coming to Fried's in New York. So oh. I called him, and I said, I'd love to take you to dinner when you come to New York. Well, that became a great friendship. I went to London. He came to New York when there was a premiere of the Red Shoes, a Broadway show, and he was invited because he made the shoes. He took me to – anyway, I learned so much. And later, I took a photographer with me. To do another book, and we went through Fried's again. I learned so much, took pictures of the whole thing. Well, what happened was when he was 65, Fried's was really stupid. They let him go because they said at 65 you have to retire. Well, he was vital. It's, you know, there was nothing wrong with him. So Block scooped him up and said, we want you to make a whole line of Bach point shoes exactly like Fried's. So they have a whole group of point shoes made the way they had made in the past, and he has since died, but he worked for a long time. And so Bloch has every kind of shoe you can imagine. So some of them have the light Fried way you make, and you, if you look in my book, you'll see Fried's break in one way to do it, and break in B. And that's, they don't say, they never say that, well, this is the way Fried's made them.
Hmm.
Isn't that interesting? So there's two ways to break it in, and so you have to be more careful with the lighter, more paste shoe than you do with...
Wow, that is interesting. Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So, not to, okay. So how did you start writing the book? Did you just have an interest? Did you ever have any writing background, or did you just tell me about it?
Okay. It's very easy to tell you about. No, this is interesting. I have no writing background, but this is what's so interesting. You know, I went to school in Mount Dora, and back then, the town, you know, Disney had not arrived yet, so it wasn't a boom town. Orlando wasn't a boom town. You know, Orlando, I mean, we thought Orlando was big, but it had not, you know, it had not exploded. So the interesting thing is my father went to Mount Dora High School, and he had an English teacher by the name of Nana, N-A-N-A, initial T, Laney, L-A-N-E-Y. Now, she was very young, I guess, just when my dad was in school. And she was an incredible grammar teacher. So I heard for years that little old Mount Dora, we only had in our science lab, we only had one microscope, right? So our science was not the strongest area. But everybody, I had an older brother, and everybody who finished Mount Dora High School and took like the SATs, whatever, made the highest grammar scores in the whole state of Florida. They go up to University of Florida, whatever. Everybody made like 99 percentile. We knew our grammar. And luckily, I had Nana T. Laney. She retired right after. I think she might have retired at the end of my senior year. So everybody, we just knew grammar really well, and she made us write, and so we just knew it inside out. So then when I went to, at the time there's no Orlando Junior College now, but I went to Orlando Junior College. All the Orlando people, I always felt they were snobs. They looked down their nose at the Mount Dora. But I thought to myself, don't look down your nose in English class. Because they didn't know grammar for anything. I mean, they usually just read literature. And so then I had a really good grammar teacher in college, but I already knew it. I knew it all. But anyway, it was just a great refresher. And all the Orlando people struggled like crazy. So I had that background. Then in college, I had a great writing lab where they just made us, you know, write a lot of themes. But I had grammar at my grasp, so I had no problem with that. So I had a background that way. Then when I was dancing, I danced with both the Baltimore Ballet and the Maryland Ballet for a long time, and I injured my back, and I couldn't dance for 2.5 years. And I was looking for something else to do, and a friend of mine, this is really funny, a friend of mine said, Janice, you have an outgoing personality. They need a weather girl at the TV station. So I thought, hey, I might as well try for it. This is in Baltimore, where all the riots are now. Anyway, so I made up a resume, and I was trying to think, what do I write for the weather girl? I know nothing about the weather. And but I'm used to, you know, being in public, and I took speech classes, and I could write. Right? Uh-huh. So I sent, this is so funny, I sent in my resume to the TV station, ABC, and they called me in for an interview, and when I got there, I was so embarrassed. They said, we received your photo and resume, and we liked it, but we didn't know you forgot to say what job you were applying for.
Oh, my goodness.
And they called me in anyway. I thought that was interesting. So I thought, oh, for the weather girl. It just shows you to be aggressive because you never know what will happen. So they said, well, I don't think you're right for the weather girl, but we want to start a section before, I mean, we have an opening entertainment critic. We've never had that, where we'll do the arts and movies. So I thought, well, why not? Why not? So they sent me out to review a movie. And, oh no, before they did that, wait. They wanted to see what my writing skills were. So they sent me out into the newsroom with a typewriter. And you don't have your own cubicle or anything. It's really loud. They're coming in and out with breaking stories and everything. And they said, they gave me the newspaper and they said, okay, you see this news item? I want you to rewrite that news item in different words, but say the same thing. And I'd never challenged myself professionally like that. I'd just done it, you know, in high school and college, and it was easy. Boom, 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 boom. It just seemed easy. Well, they made me do two or three, and they said, oh, you can write. It sure shocked me. You know, it's like something I didn't really do. But we were already in writing that don't use the same verb, you know, two sentences, don't use the same adjective. You don't want to say, oh, this is an incredible show, and then the next line say something else was incredible. I mean, I knew things like that. So anyway, they did. The ballet companies and the visiting and movies, but they wanted me to get more controversial and say, you know how they are, like saying little nasty snide things. They are TV. And you know what? I couldn't bring myself, so they let me go. I couldn't start making snide, awful, rude remarks about the people. I just couldn't do it. It isn't in my nature to do it. So I lost my job because of that. But I thought, oh, well.
Oh, my goodness.
I thought, but it was very good training for me for writing and, you know, delivering little talks. And so that sort of got me started writing, thinking about it, because I had to write my own script. But then I thought, well, you know, I don't want to interview all these dancers. I want to dance. I'm going to find a way to get back into dancing. I'm going to feel myself. And I did. Doctors couldn't help me, and I just figured it out and got back to dancing. So that was incentive for me. So then I have a really good girlfriend. I was back in New York. And I have a really good girlfriend I've met in Baltimore whose godfather and godmother owned half of Capizio. But she was a writer. She wrote musicals, and she taught in colleges and coached musicals and wrote lyrics and everything. Well, anyway, she said to me back in the 80s, you know, Janice, there are no books on pointe shoes and pointe training. Now, we were really good friends, but her mother was a ballet teacher too, but she wasn't a ballet person, but she learned ballet. Mm-hmm. And she actually had a Capizio store at one time in Baltimore to make extra money. She said, there is no book on the market that talks about anything about pointe shoes, none. And she said, I will help you if you'll write a book about it. Well, I was dancing professionally and taking class every day and performing. And I really wasn't interested. I was too interested in dancing. And she kept encouraging me. And I don't know why, but one day I went to my chiropractor. His name was Nathan Novick. And lots of ABT and New York City ballet dancers went to him. We loved him, and he understood dancing, and he expert with his hands. And I was sitting in the waiting room, and Martine Van Hamel was sitting in the waiting room at the same time. Do you know who she is?
No, I don't.
Okay. She was a big star with American Ballet Theatre at the time. And when she retired, she kept working like a ballet mistress. And she still is a coach, and she works with AB. She's very famous ballerina and really strong technician. So anyway, she was still dancing then, and she was waiting. And out of the blue, I thought, I think I'll start my book today. So I had to find a scrap piece of paper in my purse, and I went over, Martine. I said, I'm writing a book about brain juice and brain training. I don't know why it just came to me. I asked her, I hadn't even thought about what questions. I just said, well, what kind of shoe do you wear, you know, and what size, and how do you fix your ribbons, and, you know, what are your special, blah, blah, blah. And I had this little teeny interview. So I called my friend Sarah and said, I started the book. Well, because I was studying with David Howard, and all the famous people were there.
Mm-hmm.
ABT and New York City Ballet, they were there. And some of them were my friends, and some of them just saw me every day. So I just started asking everybody for interviews. Then I thought of more and more questions. The interviews got longer. Then I got to thinking, in fact, you know Alessandra Ferry?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, she retired a couple of years ago, but she was new with ABT then, and she had just made the movie Dancers with Brezhnikov. And I caught her in the dressing room, and she had the most gorgeous feet. Oh, my God, gorgeous feet. Still does. She's coming back to dance after she retired. She didn't like retirement. But anyway, so she gave me this wonderful interview and told me about Vamp Elastic. I'd never heard about it, and then she'd gotten it in London. She's a huge high instep, very high instep. And so at the Royal Ballet, they didn't let you wear elastic on your heel. They felt like it restricted your Achilles tendon.
Wow.
So they had this big, big roll of elastic, and that you would cut it and sew it into your whole front of your foot. So if you go on point, the elastic would keep you from falling over.
Oh.
For people with those great big insteps, and very common in England, but never heard of over here. And I thought, oh, boy. And she said, I even wore it in the movie for close-ups. You can't see because it came up to where her ribbons crossed. So her ribbons, you know, would hide where the elastics ended. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
sewed it all the way down, you know, with great big needle all the way around and held footed. Well, that was something new I learned. So then I got to thinking, oh, I'm getting all these dancers. It's interesting. I have to speak to people in schools. So the first thing I did is I went to School of American Ballet. And I was just sitting there, and I was just going to ask them, could they make an appointment? Could I speak to the head of the school? Well, they ushered me right in for the interview. I had to pull out old envelopes out of my purse because I wasn't prepared. Everything fell into place. It was like a dream project. I can't believe it. It's like I must have been living right, because no matter what I wanted to do, it happened.
Wow.
In I went. And I went, and they told me everything. Well, then I thought, well, I've got to go to some other. But everything I thought about happened. So then I went to SCB. And then I thought, I want to go to the Royal Ballet School in London. I started thinking really big. And I didn't know anybody to give me on. Used to, when I was dancing with a couple of companies, there were two English girls that with English National Ballet, and then the National Ballet in Washington, and I read in Dance Magazine, they both retired, one was the assistant, and one was the principal of the ballet school, so I saw where they were. I had a good friend that lived in Houston. Pardon?
You're breaking up on me. One was the assistant of Royal Ballet?
No. I thought I was going to try to get information because I thought they were back in England.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't. They'd gone to Houston.
Oh.
And one of them was the assistant to Ben Stevenson, who was the artistic director of the Houston Ballet.
Oh, wow.
And the other was the principal of the Houston Ballet School.
Wow.
So I saw where they were, and I called them on the phone. Can I come down and get all this information? Why, yes, you can.
Oh,
and I had
wonderful.
A girlfriend. I had a girlfriend that lived in Houston, so she let me stay with her for free. And I went to the school. They let me interview the director, who was my friend. Then she I had my tape recorders, and I would sit in the classes, and I would say, they could hear the music in the background, the tape recorder, and then I would say what they were doing, like, releve, up, 2, 3, 4, press into the arch, and you could hear the music in the background, and
wow,
straighten the legs, whatever. So then I could record all the exercise right on the tape recorder. And then in the company, I interviewed the choreographers, and I interviewed the director. Oh, it's just amazing. And then they had a Pilates center there, so then I interviewed the Pilates center at Houston Ballet. Then I was thinking, everybody was telling me, there's an incredible dance doctor in San Francisco, Dr. Mm-hmm. Garrick. And I thought, who do I know? I was in Houston. Who do I know in San Francisco? Well, back then I called into my answer machine in New York,
mm-hmm.
and one of my best friends was the director of the Colorado Ballet, and his wife
wow.
had injured her knee. So, oh, I know. No, I'm jumping ahead. He said, Janice, I have a dancer that I want to send to New York to be coached by someone, but she needs a place to stay. Can she stay in your apartment? I said, yes, and listen right now, but she can. I'll arrange it with the doorman. Then I said, how is your wife, Patricia, doing? He said, she's hurt her knee badly, and she's going to San Francisco to work with Dr. Garrick. I just heard today before that he was incredible. I said, where is she staying?
Oh.
She's staying at one of the, her name was Evelyn Cisneros, the main principal dancer with the San Francisco Ballet. She's staying
wow.
at her apartment. I said, is there room for me? When's she going? Like another 2 weeks. And so I flew to San Francisco. There was Patricia working with Dr. Garrick. And Martin, the one in Colorado, he had been ballet master with San Francisco. And so it was just amazing. He said, there's a new director, though, and I don't have an in with her, and she's supposed to be really mean and difficult. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. So anyway, by this time I've learned you have to stick your foot in the door, because a lot of people will, you know, if you don't ask and if you're scared. I used to be scared. Oh, I'm still getting over being scared. So the day we arrived in San Francisco, the San Francisco Ballet School was having a big performance and a reception. Well, we
mm-hmm.
just went uninvited to the reception.
Oh my.
Just went. Yeah, you've got to get your foot in the door. And so there's this woman just frowning. And I thought, oh, no. Well, my friend, Martin's wife, she was afraid of her. So I thought, okay, it won't hurt. I thought, now how am I going to get her to say yes to an interview? She doesn't know me. So I thought, I know. I've already interviewed School of American Ballet, and it's more prestigious than San Francisco Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, now I'm going to say, I've done something that's better than you. Would you like to be included too? But I won't say it that way. And
okay.
it worked like a charm. I said, oh, hello, so-and-so. And the first thing I said, I thought, she didn't care about my name. I'm from New York. Oh, that was magic. I'm writing a book on point shoes and point training. And I said, I've already interviewed so-and-so and so-and-so at School of American Ballet. And I was wondering if you would allow me to include your school in the book. And she said yes. And she never says yes to people. She's mean. Well, I said, don't put any of this stuff in. And she was hard. She was still frowning the whole time I interviewed her, but I got the interview. And then my friend knew teachers in the school, so we went to watch all the classes, and they let me record the classes, and then we go to dinner. It was a magic experience. So then I still had not gotten Royal Ballet. And I went to a summer course learning to be a better teacher in Michigan. Well, who do I see but this really good friend of mine, Misha, the one that's the director of the Mikhailovsky Company now.
Uh-huh.
And I met him as soon as he and his mother defected from Russia in 1980. And we became really good friends. I said, Misha, where are you working now? Royal Ballet.
Wow.
And the Swedish, the Royal Swedish Ballet. I said, oh, Misha, can I come over and stay with you, and can you introduce me to people so that I can put... Yes, yes, yes.
Oh.
And It just all went like that. I got the Royal Swedish Ballet, got the, and then I just, once I was in London, oh, and then I called everybody and just barged into, oh, and Freed, you know, they just said yes. And then Gamba, I said, I've already gotten all the information from Freed. Can I come out to your factory? And Gamba was jealous of Freed. So I learned how to work people.
That is, you know, you really know how to work your, that's amazing.
Yes, it changed my whole life because I started thinking how to be crafty. And before I was shy, and I thought if I'd stayed shy, I would have never gotten any of this.
Exactly.
Anyway, it just went on and on and on. So let me tell you two more really good stories about how I got in the door. It's amazing. So I was working with New York Theater Ballet, and the director was Frank Oman. He used to be with New York City Ballet, and I really liked him. And he was very good friends with Violette Verdi. Do you know who she is?
Oh, of course.
Violette Verdi. Okay. So he talked about Violette all the time, Violette. So anyway, I thought, I want to go to the Paris Opera Ballet School, and I don't have any ins. I'm trying to think. Well, at the time, this was like 1989 or something. At the time, I'd gone to almost every place. I thought, I've got to end this eventually. I can't go everywhere. And so I thought, I'm just going to take a chance and see if Violette Verdi is in the New York phone book, because she was working with New York City Ballet at the time, coaching and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called. I knew that the operator wouldn't say Violette Verdi. She would say Violet Verdi. That's what it looks like. So I said, is there a Violette Verdi on the Upper West Side in the book? Yes, West 63rd Street. I knew that was it.
Oh.
I just called her on the phone. And she's really, I danced in a performance with Giselle with her once, and she really didn't remember me, but she's really friendly.
Wow.
Oh, yes. I'm writing a book on point shoes and point training, and I said, I've already interviewed people at School of American Ballet, the Houston Ballet, San Francisco Ballet, the English National Ballet, the Royal Ballet, and she stopped me and said, you must go to the Paris Opera Ballet.
Wow.
Can you imagine? I mean, it's like magic. It's just magic. You must go. I said, that's why I'm calling you, because I don't know who to call. I mean, I knew the director's name, but I don't have any entree. Oh, just a minute. Claude, believe it or not, is a woman's name in French, C-L-A-U-D-E, and she was really tough, too. But Claude Bessie is one of my best friends. I will tell you, you're going to call her, and you're going to tell her that Vila insists that she see you. So she came out, and she gave me the major, the phone number for the school, the phone number to the Claude Bessie's private secretary, and her own personal line. And she said, you call. And I did. And I went. It was incredible.
Wow.
And this was another thing that I learned, because I was teaching at a school at the time, and I was always trained, you don't miss classes, you don't miss rehearsals, you always do it. And so I would have had to take off like 2 weeks in February to go when the Paris Opera Ballet would let me do it. They told me the time I could come, and I couldn't do it any other time, which meant I'd have to take off. And so I was going to sheepishly go in and ask my employer if I could get off. And then I thought to myself, what if he says no? See, I'm teaching how to be aggressive. What if he says no? Then what will I do? Because I really want to do this. So then I changed my way again. I got more aggressive. Instead of asking, I went in and said, I have this incredible opportunity. I'm going to the Paris Opera Ballet School in February. He said, where? Let me see so I can get a sub. And so I said, let's do it. And I thought, why have I been this little meek thing, the asking permission to do things? I mean,
exactly.
I'm not a child anymore. You know,
you
that's what you
asking,
do as a child.
Yeah, you weren't asking. You were telling him that I am going to Paris Opera.
Yes, and I said it in an excited way, but not a bossy way. You know, attitude means everything. Oh, and I didn't want to, like I was forcing him, and like this great opportunity I'm going. And he was excited, and I thought, I could have ruined that by asking. Because he might say, oh, that's a very bad time for us or something. I mean, here I am. I mean, I'm more than grown up. I've been grown up for years, but I still was acting like a little girl. Like, this whole thing changed my whole life. And so anyway, that worked. And then another miracle Did you ever hear of the very famous ballerina? I mean, she's been dead now for quite a long time. Alexandra Danilova.
Actually, no, I have not.
Okay. You have to read up on your history.
Oh,
she, back during the World War One, you know, and then it was the Russian Revolution where the, you know, the communists came in, that all the dancers had to leave Russia. They went to Paris. And George Balanchine was one of the ones. Well, anyway, he married her at one time. He married like seven people. But anyway, she was with a Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, like, I don't know if I can say the most famous, but one of a handful of the most famous ballerinas in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And so then she went, then she taught at School of American Ballet up into her 90s.
Wow.
And so anyway, I was in back in New York, and I thought, I've got to pull this together. I have just got to pull this together because I can't just keep, I interviewed, and I was teaching and dancing at the same time, and I thought, it took me 2 years to get all these interviews. It takes a long time to transcribe, as you know. So I've got to stop. I thought, is there one more really wonderful thing that I should do? And I thought, I know, I should interview Danilova. I should interview her. She's old. She's still here alive, and she's teaching. And, oh, I've not talked to anybody with this kind of history. And you know what's funny? I was had just left Lincoln Center. I was sitting in front of Juilliard School on a little planter waiting for the bus. And as I decided that's what I should do, I looked up, and she was standing right in front of me.
Wow.
Can you imagine? Waiting for the bus.
Wow.
Magic. It's magic. It was in my mind, and there she was. And I thought, oh, I went running over. Oh, Madame Danilova, this is what I'm doing, blah, 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 blah. And I was so afraid the bus would come. She had to get on the bus. And before I got the bus, it took its time. And she said, I would be glad to meet me at School of American Ballet on whatever day. You can come watch me teach class, and then we'll go into my dressing room, and then you could interview me.
Wow.
And I thought, this whole thing, well, it was just amazing, just amazing. That was the first, my first time. I mean, I've rewritten a book several times. But anyway, my girlfriend, though, that talked me into doing it, I mean, there was a lot of transcribing. First, you have to transcribe it, everything everybody said. Then you've got to decide what you cut out and how you put it into a form. So I could never have done it without her. She wrote the proposal to the publisher. And she did a good deal of the formatting because, but luckily she discovered that I can write too, so we were both writing, but she's the one that guided me because she'd already written books and she's a lyricist and all that kind of thing. I started writing for dance, a lot of different dance magazines, and I really got it under my belt. So, and the next two times that I've rewritten the book, she's got too many other things to do. She doesn't have anything to do. I keep her name on it because I would have never done it without her. She doesn't do it. So I've done all of the writing, and I just sort of found out, you know, the style of writing that they want. I'm not writing a novel. This is information, you know. It's like a textbook.
Yeah.
But, and I kept saying to the editors, though, in the beginning, I wanted to make some of it interesting. They've allowed me a little more leeway lately. Like, when I interviewed Darcy Kissler, I'm sorry. She was wearing the cutest red boots and the cutest earrings and things, and I wanted to add all that in. And they kept saying, no, this is textbook. This will be, you know, used. That's just too much. That's too much. But this last time, they let me put in a little bit. A little bit colorful information. And I could do that in the magazines, you know. But anyways, I've rewritten it, and then I've rewritten another point book. It wasn't mine, but there's a famous dancer named Thalia Mara who died in her 90s a few years ago. And the publishers asked me to update it because it was rather old-fashioned and then add a section to it. So I've done that. So anyway, I just say all because of Nana T. Laney, that I knew all the rules of grammar, and then writing labs and everything, that it was just, and I think actually writing all the, when I had the spots on television, it made me sharper, you know, so I had that background. But I do not have a degree or anything in that, but I've had absolutely, I'm just lucky that
it seems like you've it seems like you've led such an extraordinary life. And you are, oh my goodness. But tell me about your family. How did you work with your family through your career and all these opportunities that you've had?
Well, I actually gave up a lot of opportunities because of my family. I have a few regrets, but I guess you really shouldn't ever have regrets.
Yes.
You know, I guess you shouldn't have regrets. What I really wanted to do was to go right to New York and then just stay there forever and just be a career woman. And at one point, quite early in life, I got weak and got married. And I'm not putting it down. I mean, it was a good marriage. And I have my daughter because of that. But I did not do all the dancing that I wanted to do. In fact, that's why I ended up in Baltimore. I left mm-hmm. New York. And I ended up in Baltimore doing a lot of dancing, and I would rather have been in New York. And I got quite frustrated because there are not as many opportunities. There's more opportunities in New York. Now, mm-hmm. New York is not far from Baltimore, so I got to see everything. I was always on the train going to see everything, and I kept all my friends, and I would go up and take classes all the time, you know, when I wasn't performing. But to me, I kind of regretted, honestly, getting married because I wanted to stay in New York. I thought my husband would move to New York. But he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a little frustration. But I also made sure that, you know, before there would be a child, that I said the deal was I needed full-time live-in help.
Mm-hmm.
Do I sound mean? A lot of women sound like that.
No.
Or I wouldn't do it because I did not want to have to quit dancing because I was a mother.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I did. I got full-time live-in help. But now, sometimes, guess what? Sometimes they get sick, and so it's not easy. It is not easy. I mean, you have to really juggle a schedule because there are always more dancers ready to take your place.
It's
not like businesses when you call in for a sick day and you still get paid, too.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to take your place when you're not there in a performance.
And then, of course, even with you being sick, you have that one day off. So not only your place in the company could change, but your body could change just in one day.
That's right. So I just made really sure. And then I made sure there were no more children because I just knew I couldn't juggle but one. And on top of that, I had a live-in help. And then I had, of course, she needed a day off and she needed a vacation now and then. And then there was a really good friend of mine she had some dire circumstances and she was a good deal younger than I, and she came to live with us. She needed a place to live. And so she worked, but she was a very big help, you know, when I'd be called out, you know, for evening. So I actually had like two people helping me.
Oh,
but,
how nice for them to do that for you.
And then as time went by, though, I got divorced, and then my daughter and I were in New York. And when I remarried this time, I was living in New York, and he was living in North Carolina. This time, he moved to New York.
Oh.
I wasn't going to do that.
Yes. Well.
But so you wonder why I'm back in Florida, is because he retired. He's been retired for several years. He's saying, I want to go back home, because he's from outdoor, too. And finally, okay, I'm not young anymore. So, you know, as long as I keep my apartment in New York and I go back several times a year, go to see the performances, take class, and I still have the freedom to be up as much as I can. But I'm 72 now. So I guess I'm supposed to do this. Although, to tell you the truth, I would really rather be in New York.
Yeah. Well, it seems
because
like,
it's all the ballet is there.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's, of course, my dream, to be a ballet dancer. And in order to make that work, I have to be in New York because that's where most of the...
That's where it's happening. Now, you may go elsewhere, but that's where the contacts are.
Yes.
Like, I could have never written the book if I had not lived in New York.
Of course.
I could have never written the book because I would not have known the people that gave me access to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? People I dance with, people in class, my teachers introduced me to this person. And everybody comes touring through. If I had not lived there, I could have never written the book. In fact, it's bothering me now because I feel like I've got to go back and spend a little bit more time because most of my friends in the companies now are retiring. And I've got to, I want to get to know personally the up-and-coming people. Yeah. I don't want to be on the periphery. I want them to see me day in, day out. Even if they don't know you as best friends, they see you. The ballet dancers all go to the same classes. They go to the same performance. They walk the same mm-hmm. route. You see each other all the time.
Yes.
You know, so that you really need to be there. But, I mean, I really should admit now that, you know, so I'm older. But I know it's still in my blood.
Of course. Dancing will always be in your blood. And with the life that you've lived, you live an extraordinary life. To be honest, I wish I had your life. Everything, I'm sure you've had your ups and downs, but you've lived
I've had lots of downs. And like I say, I really didn't want to move to Baltimore, and then my husband got a really, really good job, and I didn't have a job at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you get married, sometimes you have to make those compromises. And I actually, as I look back, I made really good friends. In fact, for instance, the man who was running the Colorado Ballet, he and I danced together in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that got me taking all those Vaganova teacher courses. Here's the thing. I kept up with my friends. Once they moved different places, I always called them and went to see them. That's the key. I stayed mm-hmm. friends with all my old friends. My husband did not do that, and so the people kind of drift away. But if you keep up with your old friends, what happened is, like the people I danced with, they ended up in the Houston Ballet. You know,
and that's how you got your contacts.
Yes, and so right, and then I'm trying to think. Oh, and then my friend Misha, I actually was not a good teacher then, but he and I taught at a big dance convention. He and his mother defected from Russia, and they got uh-huh. their first job as a convention, and he was brand new to the United States, and I was really friendly to him, and I tried to help him out a lot. But he is, like, really famous. His family is, like, the most famous dance ballet family in all of Russia, and yet I helped him get, I didn't realize that so much at the time. Now, he has helped me so much, I cannot tell you. And I just was in Russia, and he paid for my hotel. I'm just sitting there watching anything I want. He paid for my hotel. Well, I stayed with him in London. He paid for my hotel in Stockholm. He introduced me to all the most famous people. So I kept up with everybody that I knew when we were all dancing together or early young teachers together and people scattered. I mm-hmm. always, if I was doing a dance convention someplace, I always said, can I come by and see you? So it just ended up that my friends were either teachers, ballet masters, ballet mistresses, directors, choreographers, than when we used to be. So keeping up with people really pays off.
Yeah.
And that I just went down to Boca Raton recently. I saw that there was a big performance with all the schools in South Florida. And two friends of mine are down at Harrod. And
Harrod,
I wanted to go down and see. Yeah.
Oh.
So,
To their summer intensive this summer.
Well, Victoria.
Yeah.
Well, she used to dance for my friend Martin that we used to be with the Colorado Ballet. Martin and I used to dance together in Maryland Ballet. And then Donald, her friend, used to dance with my partner and me, Eddie. I can't believe it's like this circle. So I just went down to see them and to see this performance. You keep up, and then you keep getting, and they'll tell me, like, oh, there's somebody you need to interview for this, or somebody, a good doctor, or, you know, or whatever. So the key is keeping up with all your old friends that are in the business.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Janice Berger. She is a real inspiration for any dancer. Thank you so much for listening. This brings us to the end of the Dance XOXO show. Make sure to head over to my blog at AnnikaValentine.com and sign up for my updates, and I'll catch you on my next episode.
This podcast is a production of DimplesMedia.com, delivering content that inspires lifelong learning.